When you suffer financial reverses, do you ever get the feeling that God has forsaken you? This is the devil's two-way trap. He baits one with prosperity so a man will forget God, and he baits the other with adversity so a man will blame God. In Prophets and Kings, page 174, is this very interesting observation, that when we are encompassed with doubt, perplexed by circumstances, or afflicted by poverty or distress, Satan seeks to shake our confidence in Jehovah. It is then that he tempts us to distrust God, to question his love. In my experience, a number of times people have come to me after I had pointed out to them the promises in the Bible, especially the one that says if we make the kingdom of heaven our first consideration, that all these things, that is, the basic necessities of life, will be given to us. In other words, if you follow the Lord, you can be assured of success. Be assured of success. But people have come to me and told me this: I have been faithful in my tithes, faithful in my offerings. I have tried to follow the Lord, but my business is going downhill. Or my prospects for work, or whatever it happens to be. That their financial situation has worsened. In each one of these cases, I would try to point out that possibly the Lord was testing them, or, well, whatever I tried to tell them, I don't think it was very convincing because I didn't feel very convinced myself. I almost felt as if the Lord had let me down, because here I had promised them from his book that they would be cared for, and now they were suffering reverses. And it bothered me. And then one day I was reading, and I came across this quotation: "You may be perplexed in business, your prospects may grow darker and darker, and you may be threatened with loss." And I cannot tell you with what eagerness I read the rest of that quotation. But you're going to have to wait a while before you hear the rest of it. First, let us look at the subject of prosperity and adversity. We normally associate prosperity with success and adversity with failure. This is a normal judgment. But what is prosperity? If you were to ask me for a definition of prosperity and ask Rockefeller for his definition, I'm sure you'd get two widely divergent definitions. In the great crash of 29, the great stock market crash, there were men who jumped out of their office windows over Wall Street and crashed to the street below because they had lost till they were down to their last $500,000. And of course, you all know what a traumatic experience that is, to get down to your last $500,000. Now, their idea of prosperity and the idea of someone else's prosperity, you can see, is extremely different. I would submit a definition of prosperity. Prosperity is having what you need when you need it. Will you buy that? Prosperity is having what you need when you need it. If you have more than this, it is some degree of wealth. If you have less, it is some degree of poverty. Now, is prosperity good or bad? Quite obviously, it must be good. In the little book, Our High Calling, page 193, means is valuable and to be desired. It is a blessing. A precious treasure if used prudently, wisely, and not abused. From the same source, I read that want and poverty are evils and to be dreaded. There is a general principle involved here. which is this, that the amount of talents we are given is proportioned according to the capacity possessed by the person. If God gave us more than we were able to handle wisely or to manage wisely, this would be unfair because he holds us responsible and accountable. And then imagine God holding us responsible and accountable for that which we were incapable of handling wisely. So he only trusts us with as much as we can handle wisely. That's the basic principle. In prosperity, however, there's a great danger. It is so beautifully put this way, that it is not the empty cup which we have trouble in carrying. It is the cup full to the brim that must be carefully balanced. And anyone who has tried to carry a full glass of water or a full cup from one place to another in the kitchen or in the dining room knows what this is all about. And so here vividly we have portrayed the danger of prosperity, that in prosperity there is always a danger. Once upon a time there was a lady who was very poor. She lived a very hard life. Her husband had great talent, but he had a drinking problem. And so the money which should have gone to the sustenance of the family went down to the local saloon. However, this lady was a very dedicated person who loved the Lord. And as she would sit in church, she would look around and she would say to herself, I wish I were as prosperous as Squire Jones or Deacon Brown, then I could really give to the Lord's cause. As it was, she had sometimes a mere pittance to put in and other times none at all, but she loved the Lord's work. So she kept voicing this desire. And one day we're told that the Lord said to one of his agents, I have proved her in poverty and affliction, and she has not separated herself from me. I will now prove her with prosperity. I will reveal to her a page of the human heart with which she is unacquainted. I will show her that money is the most dangerous foe she has ever met. I will reveal to her the deceitfulness of riches. You find this interesting story in Volume 2 of the Testimonies, page 278. After the Lord had spoken to one of his agents, the fortunes of this lady turned completely around. Now it seemed that everything she had that she touched turned to gold. She became very prosperous. What was the result? Remember now, she was wishing she was as prosperous as these other people so that she could give a great deal. Now what did she really do? What she really did was this. She bought herself a fine house, filled it with great beautiful furniture and art objects, and was actually doing less than she had before. Such was the danger of prosperity. And God, through his servant, sent a testimony to her calling attention to this fact. It's a very interesting story. You should read it someday. I know a man who went bankrupt 4 times. Each time he went bankrupt, he came back to the church and became more zealous in his affiliation there. As quick as he started to make money again, he grew careless in his religious life. One day, during one of these periods of adverse business conditions, he said, "My relatives tell me that God won't let me succeed, but I'm going to prove they're wrong." And then he started to prosper until he became a millionaire. The last time I heard, they hadn't seen him in church for a long, long time. You see, there is a great danger in prosperity. Solomon recognized this, being one of the richest men of earth, also the wisest. Notice what he said in Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9. "Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain." And Paul, writing to Timothy, 1 Timothy 6:8, "And having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts." However, let us study for a brief period the subject of adversity. First, under two divisions. self-imposed and circumstantial. Under self-imposed adversity, there is poor or mismanagement. There are those people who live up to their incomes and they're facing disaster, and those people who live beyond their incomes and they have already experienced disaster. Poor or mismanagement. And the world is filled with poor or mismanaged people. They just don't understand how to manage wisely. Then there are those who are unwilling to adjust their lifestyle to their incomes. I remembered counseling a family one evening. The husband had lost his employment, and his wife said that, well, yes, he could get another job, but it paid less than this, and we can't live on that. Just a casual observation which I made as I drove into the driveway and what I could see from where I was sitting told me why they couldn't live on that, because I saw some very, very expensive hobbies, or saw the evidences of some very, very expensive hobbies. And if they had gotten away from these, they could adjust their lifestyle. And God did not promise us our wants. He only promised our needs, because even a creative God couldn't furnish our wants. If that seems like a strange statement, just stop and think for a moment. If God said, look, I'll give you the universe. You know what we do. We'd say, you mean there isn't another one? I want two. Because we're told that a rich person is never satisfied with riches, if this is his desire. There are those people who are unwilling to accept alternate employment. I knew a man one time who said that he was looking for quality employment. Not necessarily employment which would furnish him an adequate income for his family, but quality employment, whatever that was. So at the time he was unemployed and his wife was supporting the family. There is, however, a fourth reason for self-imposed adversity, and I'm going to use the polite term. It's called indolence. There's another word that starts with L and has a Z sound in the middle. But let's just talk about indolence. Solomon said that he saw a great thing one day. He said he was passing by and he saw the field of a slothful man. It was grown up to weeds and briars and thorns, and the fences were broken down. He said, then I saw and I considered it well. He evidently stopped and just pondered on it a little bit. He said, I looked upon it and I received instruction. Now, isn't it amazing? Here's the wisest man who ever lived that sees the field of the slothful man, and he has his chariot stop right there, and he receives some instruction. And here was the instruction he received. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth, and thy want as an armed man. Thy want as an armed man. Here's the case of pure indolence. Ellen White had the interesting experience of having a testimony for a man who was an indolent man. She didn't call him lazy, she called him indolent. It's very interesting. I would advise everyone to read it. It's in Volume 5 of the Testimonies, page 178 to 182. Filled also with principles to prevent self-imposed adversity. It seems that this man, and I'll just give you a fast word picture of it. He must have been interesting. I'd like to have known him. He chatted a great deal about inconsequential things. He was either chatting with his neighbors, and when he didn't have that opportunity, he and his older boys would sit around the fire, and they would chat about these things. The fire would burn down. His wife was carrying in the wood to keep the fire going and even splitting it while he sat there chatting with his boys. The testimony that came to this man was that there was a definite relation between religion and labor. That the mind needed exercise, but also the body. That they needed to be exercised equally. that he was as responsible for his energy as the wealthy person would be for his money, that there was a definite correlation and importance between work and the Sabbath, and that if he wanted to give a sermon to the world, that the very best sermon that he could possibly preach to the world would be to make a decided reformation in his own life and provide for his family. And there were some suggestions. Suggestion number one, that he should rise while the stars were still shining. And I can imagine from the description of this man that this would be a very traumatic experience. Second, that he should begin his day with devotions. Third, he should have meals at specified times. And fourth, that he should work, he should plan something, he should complete it before he moved to anything else. And then he was told that if he'd been indolent for so long that he was incapable of planning for himself, he should put himself under someone who could plan for him. But above all things, he was to finish what he started. And five, that he was to cease to be a disgrace to God's cause because of his debts. It appears that he was locating in one place, indulging in indolence for a time, and then he was obliged to run in debt to provide for his family. And these were honest debts, it was pointed out to him, that he wasn't always particular to pay. And then instead of paying his debts, he simply moved to some other place. He was told that this is defrauding your neighbor, that the world has a right to expect strict integrity in those who profess to be Bible Christians, that by one man's indifference in regards to paying his just dues, all our people are in danger of being regarded as unreliable. Notice this again. By one man's indifference in regards to paying his just dues, all our people are in danger of being regarded as unreliable. I recall one time living in a small town, little city, I went by a furniture store where I knew both of the owners, and one of them greeted me and said, "Why don't you people pay your bills?" And I said, "I didn't know I owed you anything." And he said, "You don't." I said, "Who does?" And he named a man who had been a member of our church, and I said, "Well, that figures," because I'd heard that before. But this sort of rankled a little bit in me. He said, "Why don't you people?" And so I said to him, "Do you ever have any people of other faiths that haven't paid their bills, such as Catholics or Christians or Baptists or Methodists or Episcopalians? Have you ever had any of those that went off and didn't pay their bills?" "And yes," he said. I said, "Do you call them all deadbeats too?" But I said, "When one man, one of our members, goes off and doesn't pay his bill, you say, 'Why don't you people pay your bills?'" He said, "I guess it wasn't very fair, was it?" I said, "No, it wasn't fair." And I said, I want you to know I don't appreciate it. "Have you dealt with our people?" He said, "Yes." "Lots of them?" "Yes." "Have they paid their bills?" "Yes." "But one man, and you classed all of us together. Now, if he did this to me, you know very well he did it to other people too. The Seventh-day Adventists were unreliable." What did it say? "By one man's indifference." Doesn't say two, three, five, seven. It says one. "By one man's indifference in regards to paying his just dues, all our people are in danger of being regarded as unreliable." And this man, in this testimony, was advised that he should cease to be a disgrace to the cause, and this was caused by indolence. There are certain principles that a person might want to look at. 2 Thessalonians 3:10. The reason I bring these up is, what is our responsibility to people who are either indolent or who refuse to take advice? 2 Thessalonians 3:10. "If any would not work, neither should he eat." That's Paul's instruction. Counsels on Stewardship, page 122. "The Lord does not require the hardworking man to support those who are not diligent." Early Writings, page 57. "It is a sin to support and indulge in idleness those who are able to labor." Volume 3, page 400 and 401. "If those who have not made life a success were willing to be instructed, they could train themselves to habits of self-denial and strict economy and have the satisfaction of being distributors rather than receivers of charity." And goes on to say that many are poor because of their lack of diligence and economy. They know not how to use their means aright, and if they should be helped, it would hurt them. Some will always be poor. If they should have the very best advantages, their cases would not be helped. They have not good calculation. They would use all the means they could obtain, were it much or were it little. I had a dear friend one time who was very solicitous of a widow. And so one time during the spring season when the gardens were lush, she picked up vegetables from many people, very beautiful vegetables, and took them over to the lady's house. The lady did not use the vegetables. She simply asked her if she couldn't bring cans instead. She was too lazy to fix the vegetables. She'd rather use the can opener. Now let's look for a few moments at circumstantial adversity. Let's discuss four of these. First, accidental. Sometimes people have accidents and they get into adversity through no fault of their own. I have a neighbor that I have tremendous respect for this man. I know that every hour of the day that he has pain. I know that his leg hurts him. I know that he has headaches constantly. You see, one time he was riding down the highway on his motorcycle, minding his own business and in the speed limit, when a car went over the back of him at 110 miles an hour. The police were clocking this man. They were chasing this speeder, and he went right over the back of him. And, of course, his motorcycle went one way, and he ended up another. And they left him lay there after they checked him, and they were waiting for the undertaker to come and pick him up. And the only reason they didn't take him to the mortuary or the morgue was because when they started to put him in this vehicle, he moaned. And they took him to the hospital instead. And there, under the skill of physicians, he finally was able to be patched up enough so that he could lead a halfway normal existence. Now, this man has a total disability. He does not have to work at all because of this terrible accident. But he voluntarily went to the Social Security office and told them he was going to try to do it on his own. They said, "Do you think you can?" He said, "I don't know, but I'm going to try." And so he went into a business to try. And they said, "If you can't make it, why, come back?" And he said, "All right." But this has been going on for over a year now. And every time I see that big yellow-nosed truck heading out of his place, I shake my head in wonder and admiration for a person who had accidental adversity, but he refuses to let it get him down in spite of the pain that he may be suffering. Then there's adversity from human error. We're not all that smart, and sometimes we just make mistakes. You can't rule a person out for trying. He tried and he failed. That's all. There's no other answer. And so he'll try again. But he's in adversity and he needs help at this particular time. It's not his fault. Then there's economic adversity. And that also is of no fault. A person, for instance, will do the very careful surveys of the potential for a grocery store in a particular area. The competition will allow another grocery store. There's enough people. There's a good payroll. And so he moves in and sets up business. Everything's going well. Then all of a sudden, the big payroll of the town leaves, such as a mill or a big factory, etc. The big payroll is gone. And here he is with shelves full of groceries, and there isn't any payroll for the people to buy these things. It's happened over and over again. It's called economic adversity, and no one can control it because no one can foresee exactly what's going to happen. So here we have these accidental adversities, human errors, and economic. The fourth one is the one I want to really direct your attention to. Adversity by divine design. Isn't that a strange one? That you have adversity because God has designed that you should have adversity. This doesn't make sense. Remember now, adversity, we're talking about the fact that a person is having financial difficulties, but remember that he still will be fed, clothed, and housed because Jesus obligated his Father there. However, it may be a poor type of clothing, housing, and food. It may be not quite as adequate as we'd like to think. But why would God permit it? Why would he give us adversity by divine design? First, this ingredient. Temporal blessings are given us in trust that our use of these may determine whether we can be entrusted with eternal riches. Here we have this trust again. Second, when Christians are controlled by the principles of heaven, they will dispense with one hand as the other hand gains. This is the only rational and healthy position a Christian can occupy while having and still making money. We get this picture of reaching out our hand. God fills our hand. We transfer to the other hand and we dispense as we hold out the hand for blessings. And we constantly take the blessings from the hand which God is filling and put them into the other hand. And so we're dispensing here and receiving over here. Our problem is that many times we reach over here, we get a handful of blessings, we make the transfer all right, and then we hold our hand for more blessings, but at the same time we're clutching this hand, hanging on to what God gave us. Now we have stopped that vital chain from the supply to the need. We've stopped it. And all you have to do to stop the economy of a particular area is to stop the payroll. And this is, in essence, what we're doing. Until we get the chain to working again, we're in trouble. So we need to remember that as Christians, this is the principle of heaven that we dispense with one hand as the other gains. Okay, now we are suffering loss. And we're down to this very key quotation. I would like to say this also, that since the day that I found this quotation, every person that has come to me and said, I have done to the best of my ability, but we're still suffering loss, and I have read this, each person has said, okay, I'll accept that. I thank God for it, because they say, I will accept it, because they see it. You may be perplexed in business. In case you're keeping notes, it's from the book That I May Know Him, page 232. That I May Know Him is a little devotional book. I think you'll remember it. You may be perplexed in business. Your prospects may grow darker and darker, and you may be threatened with loss. And then there are seven things listed which we must do. First, do not become discouraged. Well, that's the easiest thing in the world. That is the first thing we tend to do when we're suffering financial loss, is to become discouraged. But we're not to be discouraged. Why? Two, cast your cares upon God. Three, I think is a strange one, remain calm and cheerful. How can you remain calm and cheerful when you're losing your shirt? Remain calm and cheerful. Remember, you've cast your cares on God. Remain calm and cheerful. Four, begin every day with earnest prayer, not omitting to offer praise and thanksgiving. Five, ask for wisdom and discretion to manage your affairs and thus prevent loss and disaster. Six, do all you can on your part to bring about favorable results. Seven, when relying upon your tried helper, you've done all you can, accept the result cheerfully. And then the clincher. Perhaps success might have been the worst thing for you. You see, God is trying to get each person to heaven. He could get Abraham there as one of the wealthiest sheiks in the desert, but he might not be able to get me there if I had $40 in my pocket. And so he knows whether prosperity will get to me or not. And who cares? Do you want a lot of money to go to heaven? You're not going to need it. You can't take it with you. Because he has fabulous wealth there waiting for you. So as long as we get there, what do we care what happens down here? He has promised to look after us. He's promised to take care of us. He says we won't have any trouble. David was disturbed when he saw some wicked folks being prospered, some good ones in adversity. He said, I couldn't understand this. Here are people following the Lord. They're having problems. Here are people that don't care about God, don't even believe in Him. They're prospering like just beautiful. Then he said he went into the sanctuary. What did he see there? He saw the end. And he saw those who were following the Lord going to glory and those who were not following the Lord having their reward also. And then he was perfectly satisfied. We should realize that God never leads His children otherwise than they would choose to be led if they could see the end from the beginning and discern the glory of the purpose which they are fulfilling as co-workers with Him. Our devised plans often fail, that God's plans for us may be a complete success.